We've learned the hard way many times that chemicals that appeared to make life easier for people make it a lot harder for other creatures, and the effects often come back up the food chain to us. A class of chemicals, substances known by the shorthand PFAS, will get tests for toxicity at Oregon State University. OSU recently secured a grant of nearly $2 million from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Here's our chance to learn more about the substances and the tests they'll be run through at Oregon State. Dr. Robert Tangway is a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology and the director of the OSU Superfund Research Program and several other titles as well. Dr. Tangway, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Jennifer Field is with us as well, also a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology. Dr. Field, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So, first of all, the acronym is pronounced PFAS. Do I have that much right?
That's correct.
Okay, I didn't want to venture into the whole long thing. What does PFAS stand for?
It stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, so it's a long description for chemicals that are make surfaces not sticky in a general sense.
So
very, very widely used in consumer products.
What kinds of commercial brand names might we know that contain PFAS?
I think historically, perhaps the best known might be Scotchgard, example. But often it's hard to know what the actual chemical composition of a brand name is, because a brand name doesn't imply a particular chemistry. So that's one of the challenges to understanding what chemicals are used in what products, simply because brand names may offer clues, but they're not terribly informative.
Do you have a full list that you're working with? I mean, do we know all the things that contain PFAS? And is it pretty much anything that repels moisture of some kind might contain them?
There are probably somewhere around 5,000 chemicals in this general class.
Wow.
Like Jennifer said, you really don't know which ones are being used for some of these applications. One example would be the pizza boxes, right? The layer so the cheese doesn't stick to the pizza and doesn't get your box all wet. That's one example of the use of some of these chemicals.
Oh, okay. So it is used directly on food products then?
The FDA does mandate which ones can and cannot be used. So there are lists when it comes to food contact materials.
So are PFAS found in nature? Is this completely a creation of labs, Jennifer Field?
It's completely the creation of synthetic organic chemical processes that date back to the 40s, late 40s, early 50s. And so the highly fluorinated substances that have a lot of carbon-fluorine bonds, that is very much a man-made configuration for a molecule.
All right, so not something that would occur in any kind of natural way. So we know approximately how they're used, basically to keep things from sticking to other things. What is the major concern with these products, with the PFAS?
Well, the one concern is since they're not naturally found in the environment, the chemistry is very interesting, so they're very stable, so they don't break down. So chemicals that are used widely that are not broken down will often bioaccumulate in organisms and, as you said, in the food chain. So when you have these chemicals that we don't really understand their biological toxicity, and they're accumulating because they're so widely used, that's really the biggest concern. So Jennifer has spent many years identifying these chemicals in various tissues in many different areas of the country. So we know they're present, and they accumulate until we stop using them, and hopefully eventually they'll go down in concentration.
So, Jennifer, bioaccumulate is exactly what it sounds like. The stuff that doesn't really go away over time. We get more and more of it as we use these things around us potentially?
Well, yeah, so there's no known biodegradation pathway for the most commonly known PFASs. And so, again, that term is really a very broad term. Within that very broad term, there's a few key classes that are actually the most well-known. So most people may have read or heard about PFOS and PFOA or PFOA, however you want to pronounce it. These are members of a family of chemicals that have no known biodegradation pathway. So there's not yet an organism out there that's been identified to break them down. Now, the rest of the other couple thousand that Robert alluded to, they're partially biodegradable. But what we're seeing is that the vast majority so far studied all end up resulting in these dead-end, persistent degradation products that are either PFOA or PFOS, and or they're carbon chain link cousins. And so we've got a lot of diversity out there, but over time and, you know, in the environment, what we end up with are these dead-end products for which there's no outlet. So the analogy I've given to people is like if you go and start filling up a bathtub, you plug up the drain, you turn on the water, and so that bathtub, think of that as the earth, it fills up. So these compounds don't degrade. They also don't necessarily go into the atmosphere readily. And so they build up in this bathtub that has no outlet, outlet being, you know, degradation pathway to decrease the total mass on Earth. So as you keep producing it, they are going to end up somewhere. We do now know that they are globally distributed. That is in air and water and also in the oceans.
So the concern is not just in the bodies of any specific creatures, but the fact in the environment totally, they are just greater in amount now than they've been before simply because they don't go away.
That's true. Some of these species that have no known degradation pathway simply don't go away. Now, the idea of bioaccumulation, that tends to be, as we understand it right now, dependent on the chain link. So these substances are all have a common characteristic. They have a carbon fluorinated backbone, and that backbone has varying chain links. So the most well-known go down to C4, although they get a little bit shorter than that. The ones that we think of as the most bioaccumulative are the ones that are C8. And so they're not all equally going to have a tendency to move into organisms, say, in the environment.
We are talking about PFAS, which are per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances that the EPA wants to study more of. Therefore, they have given nearly $2 million to Oregon State University to study these. We're talking to two of the people who will be involved in that process. Jennifer Field and Robert Tangway are both professors in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State. And you can join us on the exchange with your questions and comments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Robert, it would seem like if we've had these in use since the 40s and 50s, there would have been a fair amount of study already.
Yeah, so you may assume that. Unfortunately, the burden of proof on identifying whether a chemical is toxic is really on the EPA. So a company can produce chemicals and use them in products, and they don't really have to demonstrate that they're safe before they do so. So we kind of have to wait until we may see an adverse effect in the environment or in people. So there's certainly the interest of these compounds has been gaining in the last, say, 20 years as chemists have been identifying them in the environment. But really the understanding the toxicity or the potential toxicity of the chemicals is really lagged behind the chemistry to try to chase these chemicals down in the environment and in tissue. So we and others have been advocating to the EPA and the National Institutes of Health that they really need to study the toxicity of some of these chemicals so we can better protect people and the environment.
Do we even know how they work in the body, in the human body, for example? I mean, it seems like a product that is meant to keep moisture from being in some places could have some really deleterious effects on bodies that run on moisture.
Like Jennifer said, the two compounds have been studied the most, PFOA and PFOS, and even with those compounds, our understanding of how they're interacting with biology and how these chemicals are affecting biology are really poorly understood. And really, it's just a matter of there hasn't been a focused attention by any of these funding agencies to try to better understand how these chemicals work. That's why we're excited to finally work together with this large team that we built so we can start filling in those gaps, looking at the various chemistries that Jennifer mentioned and understanding how they interact with systems and whether or not they're all toxic. And so we really can't definitively answer that right now. There may be better chemicals to be used from this mix in products that may be less toxic than the others, and we hope to find that information and provide that to.
Have some of the PFAS chemicals been phased out already?
No. There was a, quote, voluntary effort by 3M back in 2001 to voluntarily remove their C8 chemistry from the marketplace. That voluntary action was really, I believe, a result of some strong negotiations between the EPA and 3M. So there was that phase out, but then there was a stewardship action where it took the remaining alternative chemistry, so the telomer industry members also with the EPA trying to drive down the C8 chain length of the alternative PFASs that were out there. And so that effort does appear to have had some effect in driving down the C8 chain links in the fluorinated alternative, sort of the non-3M chemistry. So there's been a variety of activities, but by no means have they been entirely, because remember, PFASs is a pretty broad brushstroke here. It's kind of tough to generalize because there's so many members of that class, many classes within the class. So there's still plenty out there in the marketplace, and then of course, like many substances that come under scrutiny, alternatives pop up for which they might have similar functionality and maybe some similar issues, but they're not as well studied. So the alternatives are presented often before we know much about them. I would like to say something briefly about why these materials may have toxic interactions. They're very, very unusual. Again, going and looking specifically at PFOS and PFOA and these acid groups, what makes this class of materials is different is that they interact with proteins. Unlike classic priority pollutants, like things your listeners might be familiar with, PCBs and such, these which interact with the fats in humans and organisms, PFASs actually interact with our proteins, so you actually find them in blood and blood-rich tissues as opposed to the fat compartment. And so all of our models and understanding for bioaccumulation to fats and perhaps mechanisms that depend on, you know, molecules moving to and through fats don't necessarily apply to these molecules. So it's a whole game changer in terms of trying to understand their toxicity. And we're fortunate to have very excellent toxicologists. In addition to Dr. Tang Wei, we have one of the world's foremost protein interaction someone, Carla Eng out of University of Pittsburgh. She actually is an expert on studying PFAS interactions with proteins, which is a key, I think, to understanding some of their toxic effects.
So, Dr. Tang Wei, you mentioned the large team you've assembled for this. Let's talk about the general run of work at the Tang Wei lab. You've got a bunch of people and a bunch of fish, it sounds like, and mice, too.
Well, so my lab doesn't have mice. So, like Jennifer, let me just describe the entire team really quickly.
Sure.
So at Oregon State, myself and Dr. Lisa Trong works with me at the Sinhuber Aquatic Research Laboratory, Dr. Jennifer Field. And then at East Carolina University is Dr. Jamie DeWitt, and she's the one that the investigator has expertise of studying these compounds and their effect on the developing immune system. And then Dr. David Reif, a colleague at North Carolina State University, is an expert in data analysis and biostatistics and many other things. And then Dr. Carla Eng that Jennifer just mentioned. So that represents our entire team. So we're really trying to tackle this in a very comprehensive way. So in my laboratory, we exclusively use zebrafish as a research model for a number of reasons your listeners may be familiar with. We use zebrafish because they're at the genetic level. They're very similar to humans and, of course, similar to other fish species as well. So about 84% of the genomes are shared between us and zebrafish. So the idea would be if we could systematically get each one of these chemicals one by one or use the mixtures that are found in the environment and use the zebrafish as a biosensor to determine whether or not a given chemical produces an effect or not. So is the chemical toxic or not? And so we've been using this model for those types of questions for about 20-some years.
So will you just put chemicals into the water with the zebrafish? Is that the basic structure of the experiment?
Initially, mm-hmm. So we have many tiered approaches. Initially, we'll get all of the chemicals, verify their integrity and their purity, and then we do these exposures early in life, so early embryonic development. So early in life, all of the genes, all of the proteins, everything necessary for an organism is present during embryonic development. So we use that as a sensitive window to determine whether or not a chemical can interact with anything in that organism. And then the readouts would be look for anything that's different versus an unexposed embryo. So these differences may be looking at the development of their heart or their brain or their ability to have a behavioral response and swimming responses and touch responses. So it's a very sensitive readout on whether or not these chemicals interacted with biology and whether biology was perturbed. So was it normal or not? So what we can do thousands, tens of thousands of these assessments every day using our automated laboratory.
So either of you, over the course of a career, Robert Tanguay and Jennifer Field, do we know a lot more about toxic substances because of your work?
I can certainly say from our perspective, we screened, evaluated thousands, tens of thousands of chemicals, and we could definitively identify a large number of chemicals that are not toxic, which is great. So we're not looking for toxic chemicals. We're trying to discern the toxic chemicals from the non-toxic ones. So we can stop studying the chemicals that are not toxic and focus more of our effort on the fraction of chemicals that are more problematic for human health or the environment.
And have you studied specifically PFAS at the lab before this grant?
To a limited extent, just maybe 13 of these compounds we evaluated fairly extensively. Which really was preliminary information that we thought we were well positioned to tackle the rest of them. We've evaluated these quite a bit. So we know that certainly some of them are problematic biologically.
So when you finish research like what you're planning to do now with PFAS and the Zebra Fish, do you just simply lay out the results of the work, or do you make actual recommendations about the uses of the chemicals going forward?
Yes, that's a great question. So the first part is obviously collecting high-quality data, and so we'll do that collectively across this center. And then we want to share the information broadly. So we promise to share the information not only to our colleagues in science, but we're going to share the information directly to the U.S. EPA. We're going to make the data available to companies and stakeholders who would like to make better decisions about the use of these chemicals. We're actually going to have portals for people to just go on the web and look up a chemical, and they'll see what our data looks like. We are not regulators, but we definitely are doing this work to better inform decision makers so they can use the best data to make sound decisions.
It seems like this work could be both rewarding and, I don't know, sobering would be the other term, maybe? All right. So,
I'd say so.
All right. So, almost out of time here, but how long will the research go on PFAS?
We're funded for a 3-year period of time, but certainly Jennifer's been working in this area for many, many years, and so I suspect that the information we're going to learn from this project is going to really spur a lot of other research for years to come.
All right. Sounds like exciting stuff. I'm glad you joined us to talk about it. Doctors Jennifer Field and Robert Tanguay, professors in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University, studying per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances under a $1.9 million grant from the Environmental Protection Agency. Thank you both again for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.